Today is Christmas Eve, Wednesday, December the 24th, 2025. Merry Christmas and Happy Holidays. Welcome to the award-winning Personal Computer Show. I'm Hank Key. Big Tech has been collecting and aggregating your personal data. Do you know how big tech companies and our government are using your personal data? We have been bringing computer news, hardware and software reviews, guest interviews, and news of user group meetings since 1983. The Personal Computer Show is a three-time winner of the prestigious National Computer Press Awards. Our only advocacies are consumerism and the First Amendment. Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard on the Progressive Radio Network, live, that's prn.live, streaming on the Internet. North Korean infiltrator caught working in Amazon IT department. A barely perceptible keystroke delay was the smoking gun that led to the uncovering of a malign imposter. A North Korean imposter was uncovered working as a sysadmin at Amazon US after their keystroke input lag raised suspicions with security specialists at the online retail giant. Normally a US-based remote worker's computer would send keystroke data within tens of milliseconds. This suspicious individual key lag was more like 110 milliseconds. Amazon is commendably proactive in its pursuit of imposters, according to the source report. The news site talked with Amazon Chief Security Officer Stephen Schmidt about this fascinating new case of North Koreans trying to infiltrate U.S. organizations to raise hard currency for the Democratic People's Republic of Korea and sometimes indulge in espionage and or sabotage. Schmidt says that Amazon had foiled more than 1,800 North Korean infiltration attempts since April of 2024. Moreover, the rate of attempts continues apace, with Amazon reckoning that it is seeing a 27% quarter-to-quarter uplift in North Koreans trying to get into the Amazon Corporation. You have to look for them to find them, though. Amazon's success can be almost entirely credited to the fact it is actively looking for North Korean imposters, warned its chief security officer. If we had not been looking for North Korean workers, Schmidt said, we would not have found them. With this company policy explained, a blip on the Amazon security radar was caused early this year when a new sysadmin Amazon laptop monitor alerted security personnel about unusual behavior. If we had not been looking for the North Korean workers, we wouldn't have found them. Amazon Chief Security Officer Stephen Schmidt said that Amazon security experts took a closer look at the flagged U.S. remote worker and determined that their remote laptop was being remotely controlled, causing the extra keystroke input lag. Schmidt emphasizes that good quality security software was a key to this investigation. It turns out that the North Korean had accessed this Amazon laptop located in Arizona. A woman found to be facilitating this fraud on behalf of North Korean imposter workers was sentenced to several years in prison earlier this year, as well as red flag computer network symptoms. The fumbling use of American idioms and English language articles continues to be a giveaway when conversing with such imposters. This is just the tip of the iceberg. The problem of North Korean infiltrating U.S. corporations for profit, mischief, and before is undoubtedly a serious one. We've uncovered sizable FBI seizures of equipment recently, perhaps showing just the tip of the iceberg. More successful infiltration by North Korea, as well as hostile nations like Iran, Russia, and China, are like to be ongoing. Texas sues top TV makers for secretly recording what you watch. Automated content recognition, with the acronym ACR, is mainly used to serve up targeted ads on smart TVs. But Texas AG Ken Paxton is suing LG, Samsung, Sony, and others for hiding it away in settings. A data harvesting technique in today's smart TVs has sparked Texas to sue the top display makers, accusing them of spying on consumers by routinely capturing screenshots. This conduct is invasive, deceptive, and unlawful, Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton says. The fundamental right to privacy will be protected in Texas because owning a television does not mean surrendering your personal information to big tech or foreign adversaries. Paxton is suing LG, Samsung, and Sony, as well as Chinese companies TCL and Hisense, claiming they've been unlawfully collecting personal data by secretly recording what consumers watch in their own homes. In 2017, Vizio was fined $2.2 million for using ACR without consumer consent. The ACR usage continues today and can be tucked away in a TV's privacy policy or settings, which Paxton is now criticizing as duplicitous. Disclosures are hidden, vague, and misleading. The company collects far more data than necessary to make the TV work. His lawsuit against the TV makers argues consumers are stripped of real choice and kept in the dark about what's happening in their own homes. The TVs from the top manufacturers are actually mass surveillance systems, Paxton alleges, since the ACR systems can capture TV screens and other kinds of data on the display. Last year, a study on ACR implementations also found evidence that LG and Samsung TVs routinely send ACR data to company servers. Is your TV spying on you? Here's how to check. Still, we expect TV makers to push back against Paxton's lawsuit. That's because ACR systems don't usually relay screenshots or video footage. Paxton's lawsuit even indicates the screenshots are scanned to create a fingerprint of the content, which is then shared with TV maker servers to automatically help determine what's being watched. The fingerprint approach can also preserve some user privacy. Nevertheless, Paxton alleges the TV makers are amassing a detailed log of households' media consumption of what content was watched, when, and for how long, across all inputs and apps. But if you're concerned, you can opt out of ACR collection by checking your TV's privacy settings. Backlash over OpenAI Stargate data center in Michigan. OpenAI said yesterday that it needs more computing power. The Detroit Free Press reported that the Michigan Public Service Commission has given the green light to energy company DTE Energy to provide 1.4 gigawatts of power to a data center that will be a part of one of OpenAI's planned Stargate projects. The approval, which means the data center set to be built in Saline Township, about 40 miles southwest of Detroit, will go forward, was granted by the commission on an ex parte motion. That means there will be no public hearing for the project, where groups and citizens could express their concern and opposition to the project. The project was initially blocked by the Saline Township Board, which denied a request to rezone farmland for the data center. But the developer sued and got the land in the settlement. Once they forced their way into the town of 2,328 people, they announced plans to build three separate 550,000 square feet facilities meant to be a part of an OpenAI Stargate data center cluster that will supposedly eventually produce 5 gigawatts of computing capacity. Residents felt railroaded by the whole thing. They've held protests in response to the township's board decision to let the project move forward, and one resident filed a lawsuit to intervene, accusing the township government of violating the Open Meetings Act by choosing to settle a lawsuit in closed session without public input. That feeling surely hasn't been assuaged by the township's decision to issue an ex parte motion on the project. Saline Township is just one of several communities across the country that are getting data centers thrust upon their citizens. According to the Wall Street Journal report from earlier this year, there are a handful of counties that have become data center hotspots, usually with small towns getting targeted by developers to host the hyperscalers. While it's unquestionably a dereliction of duty by local politicians to rubber stamp these projects at the expense of their citizens, it's easy to understand the temptation. The Saline Township project, for example, promises to pour $7 billion into the community. That's only a promise. Other communities in similar situations have seen their local high schools transform, homes get built, and businesses boom, at least for a little while. While the construction of data centers has led to big upticks in economic activity in places that have been stagnant, it goes away as quickly as it arrives. They create very few long-term employment opportunities. So when the construction stops, so does a significant chunk of that flow of cash. That's before considering the environmental risk that the projects pose, especially when they're rushed to move forward before the AI bubble pops and the money dries up. Ideally, local governments would have long enough view to consider these things. Instead, it seems residents like those in Saline Township are the ones who have to consider the ramifications. One person in Michigan told The Guardian that he believes the whole project is uniquely evil because of the township board and developer doing their dealings behind closed doors. A Saline Township resident suing the board made a pretty straightforward point at a recent rally against the data center project. If it's an idea so great, AI so great, so beneficial to our community, you don't have to sue your way in. Saline Township fight is not unique. According to data from the organization Data Center Watch, at least 20 similar projects have been blocked by communities across the country in the last 3 months as they push back against their uninvited new neighbors. While these citizens may not always have allies in their local governments, they've got at least one at the federal level. Senator Bernie Sanders recently called for a nationwide pause on data center construction, arguing that companies are intentionally trying to push these projects through before lawmakers and citizens can catch up. Of course, there's a reason for AI companies trying to move so fast on these projects. Right now, investor money is flowing. These companies argue, as OpenAI recently did, that they need more compute to improve their models and eventually make tools that will generate revenue to justify all that investment. They, of course, don't actually know if these better models will start raking in revenue or significantly improve. But their only chance to even find out is by spending someone else's money. Without starting to build, even on Wall Street, that AI can be an infinite money glitch. The companies are running out of time to get those data centers up and running before the jig is up. Because the big question is, where is the return on investment? OpenAI defaults free users to cheapest model to cut back on costs. ChatGPT users who aren't paying for one of the higher tier subscriptions are going to have to talk to OpenAI's cheapest AI model. The publication Wired spotted a recent update in the release notes for ChatGPT that indicates free users and ChatGPT Go subscribers will now have their prompts served to the GPT 5.2 instant model by default and will no longer have more complicated queries routed to more powerful models. In an update dated December 11th, OpenAI indicated that it is removing automatic model switching for reasoning in ChatGPT for free and Go users. Previously, some questions were automatically routed to the thinking model when ChatGPT determined it might help. To maximize choice, free users will now use GPT 5.2 instant by default and can still choose to use reasoning anytime by selecting thinking from the tools menu in the message composer. Gizmodo reached out to OpenAI for additional details on the change, including whether free and Go users will have any other limitations on their accounts. Free and Go users who pay $5 per month for a limited subscription plan that is only available to users in certain regions will still be able to access ChatGPT's thinking model, but will have to do so manually, and presumably will have to make that change on every visit. OpenAI describes its instant model as a powerful workhorse for everyday work and learning, whereas thinking solves harder work tasks more effectively and with more polish. The change is something that OpenAI can position as a quality of life improvement for users, who were in revolt over the company's decision to automatically route users to a model based on their query. Back when the company rolled out GPT-5, frequent users of ChatGPT were frustrated by the version of the chatbot that had significantly less personality. But it's also noteworthy that the change is a cost-saving measure for OpenAI, which is almost certainly banking on the fact that a significant chunk of free users aren't going to look at the model they're using and will go along with the company filtering them into its cheapest available option. The cost savings measure for the company could come at a cost to users. Previously, OpenAI said it would route sensitive queries to its reasoning models as it displayed better responses when interacting with users showing signs of mental distress. It's no longer doing that, in part on the grounds that GPT 5.2 Instant is now better equipped to handle those situations. Hopefully, the company is right about that. Does China have a robot bubble? The Chinese government is betting that robots will drive economic growth, but the bots can't really do much yet. Robots made by Chinese startups have danced on television, staged boxing matches, and run marathons. When one company debuted its most recent robot last month, most people online in China thought it looked so much like a human that workers cut the robot's leg open on stage to reveal its metal pistons. Despite the public fascination, concerns are growing that China's robotics industry is moving too fast. The robots can mimic human movement and even complete basic tasks, but they are not skilled enough to handle many tasks now done by people. And with so many companies rushing into the industry, Beijing is warning of a bubble. Over 150 manufacturers are vying for a piece of the market. The Chinese government said last month, warning that the industry was at risk for a crowd of highly repetitive products. This generally leads to a large number of vendors fighting for a small chunk of market. China has gained an early global lead in making robots. China is using more robots in factories than the rest of the world combined. Robots have transformed Chinese factory lines, doing things like welding car parts and lifting boxes onto conveyor belts. It's not unusual to run into a robot in Beijing. Robotic machines deliver room service in hotels and buff the floors in airports. Four-legged robots help deliver packages on university campuses. Robots cooked and served food in canteens during the 2022 Winter Olympics. But China is also working on the next frontier of robotics. Robotics that not only look but think and act like people. Public and private investors spent over $5 billion on startup making humanoid robots, the same amount spent in the last 5 years combined. Chinese robot makers have significant advantages. They are able to draw on the world's strongest manufacturing sector and the backing of multiple levels of government. They are getting better at making parts like the motors and specialized screws and robot joints. Public and private firms have poured money into robotic startups in China this year. The government declared the industry would help drive China's economic growth. Experts say that the humanoid robots that have been released so far struggle with unpredictable situations. They can be programmed to follow patterns, but they have a hard time reacting to events as they happen. Making robots is not enough, said TrendForce, a market research firm in Taipei, Taiwan. Without use cases, even if they can ship the products, they don't know where to sell them. Company founders and investors believe that artificial intelligence will be the answer, and the humanoid robots could be how AI becomes a physical force in the world. In Silicon Valley, tech executives often talk about achieving what they call artificial general intelligence. There is no settled definition. For many, it is the idea that AI could match the powers of the human mind. In China, robotic companies claim they will make artificial general intelligence a reality. But there's a big gap between this vision and the current abilities of robots. Many Chinese robotic startups are working on software they hope will transform robot behavior the way large language models have transformed AI. One way that robots can learn to act more like people is by repetitively doing basic tasks. For example, a limited number of robots made by UB Tech Robotics, which is based in Shenzhen, like dozens of other startups, have been lifting boxes over and over again at electric vehicle factories. While no one is certain how useful humanoid robots will turn out to be, China has already put 2 million manufacturing robots to use. Factories in China installed nearly 300,000 new robots last year, while American factories installed 34,000. Chinese factories have also gotten better at making robots, a major advantage over foreign firms that struggle to manufacture them in large numbers. The startup of Unitree Robotics has announced plans to do an initial public offering, which could provide the capital needs to help it become China's leading humanoid robotic maker. Its latest basic humanoid robots are priced about $6,000 in China, a fraction of the price of robotics made by Boston Dynamics, long the leading American player in the industry. Boston Dynamics was acquired by the South Korean giant Hyundai Motor in 2020. Chinese robot makers can offer lower prices in part because they're getting a lot of funding from municipal governments and state-backed hedge funds. The Beijing government has started a $14 billion fund to invest in AI and robotics. Shanghai set up an embodied AI fund with an initial investment of about $77 million. Presenting the IT Pro Series with Benjamin Rockwell.
This is Benjamin Rockwell, and now it's time to get down to business. This is where we talk about computers, the workplace, and how it all intertwines. And one of the secrets that people aren't aware of, because they're off at home, they're not in the workplace during the holidays, and the whole hush that happens over the workplace is something that is really cool for IT folks. It's that kind of hush that keyboards seem louder, the hallway lights seem a little bit brighter. And a lot of people are at home, they're wrapping gifts or eating cookies or whatever it is. And surprise, surprise, the IT professional is still working hard. They've got their caffeine in hand, their sleeves rolled up, and they're not in the office because they have to be, but because this is when the real work gets done. And you're going to be sitting there. You're like, why would they do that? Well, if you understand the rhythm of systems, of people, and quiet opportunities, you might already have an idea of where I'm going. Now, this applies throughout much of IT. It varies only in certain locations where IT has to slow down during key sales periods. So if people are buying a lot during Christmas, you know, you work for a toy company, you work for a credit card company, you work for someplace that does a lot of sales during Christmas. And they refer to 13th month and Black Friday and Cyber Monday as amazing days for the company. Yeah, IT might be actually doing the other thing, backing off on their work. But on a typical day, IT work is like changing a tire while the car is still doing 70 miles an hour down the interstate. Their phones ringing and emails are piling up like snowdrifts and everybody's going, is this a bad time? While they're already starting on the direction towards a disaster. There's usually little silence or stillness in the IT department, and this leads to a lot of deferred work. We put it off till the holidays, and there are temporary fixes that are duct taped into permanence, and technical debt is growing just rapidly. And this is not ideal, and it's not sustainable, and it's not what a good IT professional wants long term. So what do I do? What is the experience in something like this for the IT folks? Well, there's fewer people around. There's fewer risks. Nobody's going to be in the middle of a presentation when we restart a server. No, nobody's going to be calling because everything froze or there's a hiccup or whatever. There's less of a chance of people reporting catastrophic failures if we make a mistake along the way. And quieter systems means we get a chance to get into a little bit more bold directions. Major upgrades that would be reckless in March all of a sudden make sense in December. And this is when we start doing big, huge storage migrations or network redesigns or security overhauls. All of these things take patience. They take time. They take uninterrupted focus. This is when IT will do the work that they need to catch up on. And I will tell you, some of the different things I've done over the years are some of those things. But I've also done a lot of documentation during that time period where I get to sit down and I get to focus and I get to put out a lot of these different documents that I deal with. All of that idea that everybody goes along with and saying, we'll deal with it later. You've heard that in business. We deal with that in the IT department tenfold. And later has arrived. And yeah, later is wearing a Santa's hat. But this is actually when an IT professional feels less stressed, not more. So you may be asking yourself, isn't overtime during the holidays a little extreme? And yes, it may look like that from the outside, but from the inside, this is all strategic. The work is calmer, the outcomes are cleaner, and the systems will start off a new year healthier than they ended the last one. See, a good IT professional knows that timing is everything. You don't repaint your house during a dinner party. You don't wait for everybody to get there, and then you start, you know, going to town there. You wait until everybody's gone, the music's off, and you've got the house all to yourself. This is craftsmanship. And this isn't really about holidays. It's just understanding all of these business cycles. We have loud seasons. We have quiet seasons. We have reactive work, which is the other 11 months. And we have proactive work, which is this time of the year. We have chaos during all of that other time. And now we have the chance to slow down, take it methodically, carefully, and with clarity. And I will tell you, I welcome that so much. Great IT professionals don't just fix what's broken. They listen for the silence and they use it wisely. And in the end, look, working through the holidays in IT is just like tuning the orchestra after the audience has left. No applause, no spotlight, just careful adjustments so that when the curtain rises again for the evening performance, everything sounds beautiful, effortless, a symphony. And if no one notices, perfect. That means it worked. I pray you remember this on this holiday. I hope that you think about your IT professionals and realize, yes, they're human too. This is Benjamin Rockwell. Back to you, Hank. And Merry Christmas, everyone.
Thank you, Benjamin. Data centers are built in regions with the wrong climate. A vast majority of cloud and AI data centers are located outside optimal temperature range. Most facilities sit outside the temperature range recommended for efficient operation. As AI growth pushes data centers into hotter regions, temperatures range recommended for efficient operation, according to a new analysis that maps global data center locations against long-term climate data. While only a minority are in regions that are persistently too hot, the findings underline how economic, political and network realities often outweigh environmental suitability when companies decide. Nearly 7,000 of the world's 8,808 operational data centers are located in climates that fall outside the where to build. The analysis published by Rest of the World combines location data for 8,808 operational data centers with historical temperature records from the Copernicus Climate Data Store. It compares those locations against guidance from the American Society of Heating, Refrigerating, and Air Conditioning Engineering, with the acronym ASHRAE, which recommends that data centers operate most efficiently when inlet air temperatures fall between 18 degrees centigrade and 27 degrees centigrade. Above that band, cooling systems work harder, energy use rises, and costs increase. Below, condensation and reliability can become an inhibiting factor. Based on that definition, nearly 7,000 data centers worldwide sit outside the recommended temperature range. The majority of those are in cooler regions below 18 centigrade, where temperature is less of a constraint, but humidity management and airflow are more important. About 600 facilities, or under 10% of the total, are located in areas with annual average temperatures above 20 degrees centigrade, where heat is a persistent challenge. Massive AI data center buildouts are squeezing energy supplies. New energy methods are being explored as power demands are set to skyrocket. In 21 nations, including Singapore, Thailand, Nigeria, and the United Arab Emirates, every operational data center is located in a zone classified as too hot under the ASHRAE recommendation. Nearly all facilities in Saudi Arabia and Malaysia fall into the same category. In Indonesia, close to half of the country's roughly 170 data centers are in overly hot regions, while in India, about 30% of its more than 200 sites are exposed to sustained high temperatures. Singapore, with average daily temperatures hovering near 30 degrees centigrade and humidity frequently above 80%, has one of the densest concentrations of data centers in the world, with more than 1.4 gigawatts of capacity already online, and the government plans to allow several hundred additional megawatts under tighter efficiency rules. Data centers accounted for about 7% of Singapore's electricity use in 2020, a share projected to rise sharply without intervention. The pressure to build in less than ideal, borderline unsuitable climates is only accelerating globally. Demand for data centers to support cloud services and generative AI is rising fast, particularly in regions that are also among the hottest. At the same time, governments increasingly require data to be stored within national borders, limiting the option to centralize workloads in cooler locations such as Scandinavia. As a result, data centers are spreading geographically rather than clustering only where cooling is cheapest. Even when data laws don't apply, decisions around data center locations are often guided by the availability and the cost of power and water. Other factors include the price of land, the frequency of natural disasters, and local governance factors like tax exemptions and building permits. Essentially, ambient temperature is one of a myriad of factors steering data center buildouts, which could explain why so many don't fit into the ASHRAE's optimal temperature range. Most Americans use AI but still don't trust it. Artificial intelligence is now part of everyday life for many Americans, but most still don't trust it. New data from a December 2025 YouGov survey shows skepticism is especially high in finance, healthcare, and other sensitive industries. While younger Americans are more open to the new technology, all generations show concerns over how much they can trust AI and whether it will eventually pose a risk to humanity. How many Americans of each generation use AI weekly? AI tools are becoming embodied in daily life. According to the YouGov AI survey, 35% of U.S. adults report using AI at least once a week. In the past year, while another 28% say they used it less often, just 30% of Americans say they haven't used AI at all. The data also reveals a significant generational divide, with 51% of Gen Zs reporting weekly usage compared to only 29% of Gen X and 25% of baby boomers. This suggests AI tools have already become a regular part of life for many younger Americans, though uptake among older groups remains limited. Trust in AI is low and declining. Despite widespread use, Americans remain cautious about AI. When it comes to making recommendations or providing information, just 5% say they trust it a lot. 26% trust it somewhat. Meanwhile, 41% express distrust. 19% not much, 22% not at all, and 23% are neutral. This suggests that while many are using AI chatbots to get quick answers to their queries, most people are not convinced they are getting accurate answers. Trust is even lower when it comes to AI system taking action. In 2025, many in the AI industry raise expectations that autonomous AI agents could start independently accomplishing tasks. Americans are skeptical. Fewer than 1 in 5, that's 18%, would trust an AI system to make a decision or take an action, even somewhat. This compares to a 53% who do not trust these systems. Even within Gen Z, the mistrustful outweigh the trustful, 43% to 26%. Although trust in AI is low, it appears to be getting even worse. When asked how their trust in AI has changed over the past year, only 1 in 5, 21%, say it has increased. More than 25% says it has decreased, while about half of all respondents, 47%, say they trust AI about the same as they did a year ago. This indicates that there has been no overall gain in public trust. And in fact, slightly more Americans report a decline in trust than an increase. Generational patterns again emerge. Gen Z is most likely to report increased trust, 33%, compared to 23% of millennials, 19% of Gen X, and just 14% of baby boomers. Which industry do Americans trust AI in? Answer is none. While people may use AI in their daily lives, their willingness to trust it varies greatly depending on the industry. No sector achieves a net positive trust score. The least distrusted sector is leisure and entertainment, which is balanced with 31% of Americans on either side for net trust of 0. Dining, -4 net trust, and tech, -4, are comparatively more trusted with AI than other business sectors. However, in sensitive or high-stakes sectors like finance, healthcare, and automotive, trust declines sharply. In financial services, only 19% of Americans trust AI, while nearly half, 48%, say they don't, for a net trust of -29. In health and personal care, 23% express trust compared to 46% who express distrust, -23%. What task won't Americans trust AI with? While most people may use AI for various tasks, most Americans draw hard lines on where it can be used. Ask what they would not trust AI to do, even in principle. Respondents identify a range of roles. Significant majority say they would never trust AI to act on their behalf without reviewing each action, 68%, or to make political decisions, 63%. Even in areas where AI is commonly applied, like travel planning or sports officiating, more than a third of Americans say they would not trust AI. Just 10% of respondents say there's no task they wouldn't trust AI with. And among the 2% who wrote in custom responses, most expressed complete distrust in AI for any task. Most Americans are concerned AI could threaten humanity. Beneath sector-specific concerns lies a deeper unease about AI's long-term implications. More than 3/4, 77% of Americans are concerned that AI could pose a threat to humanity, including 39% who are very concerned. Only 17% say they are not very or not at all concerned. AI use in the United States may be increasing, but greater exposure has not led to greater trust, especially in sectors that involve personal data, finance, or health. For businesses and policymakers, this means adoption alone is not enough. They must clearly communicate why AI should be trusted. What does it mean with all the different colors on USB ports? If you ever noticed that some USB ports are different colors, such as black, blue, red, yellow, and even orange, you should know that it's not just for aesthetics. The color of a USB port is often used to denote its speed, power output, or a unique feature. For example, blue USB ports generally indicate a USB 3.0 connection, while a red or yellow color port tends to mean that it's always on, ready to charge any device connected to it. An orange USB port typically functions much like a red or yellow USB port. It's usually a high-powered port designed for sleep and charge functionality, meaning that you can charge your phone or tablet through it even while your computer is asleep or shut down. It's important to note that these color cues aren't universal. The USB Implementers Forum, that's the USBIF, the organization that oversees USB standards, doesn't enforce any specific color coding. Manufacturers, on the other hand, use these colors as helpful visual hints, but their meaning sometimes varies between manufacturers. What does an orange USB port mean? If you see an orange USB port on your device, it usually means that the port features always-on functionality. It also means that it is USB 3.0, capable of 5 gigabits per second speeds. Sometimes it may indicate that the port is for charging only. It's similar to the red USB port, just slower. Whenever you see a color USB port in the wild, it's best to consult the device manual to find out what exactly the port is capable of. Remember, the colors are based on the manufacturer consensus, but the color coding isn't set in stone by the USBIF. You can also identify what your USB port does through some old-fashioned trial and error. Plug your phone into the port while the computer is turned on to see if it provides the always-on charging power. Or transfer a large file to your USB drive using the orange USB port and pay attention to how quickly it completes. Once you know what the orange port is built for, you can make the most of it. USB color coding explained. Once you understand what each USB color represents, managing your devices becomes simpler and more efficient. While it's important to know that the color of port isn't officially standardized, manufacturers do generally use the colors as a visual cue to signal performance and functionality. For example, blue or teal ports means faster data transfer with USB 3.0 or later speeds. Red, yellow, and orange often mark high-powered connections for charging even when your PC is off, and black indicates, the good old-fashioned USB 2.0 compatibility. All that said, not every manufacturer follows these conventions perfectly. A red port on one laptop might behave differently from the same color on another. By learning to decode these color differences, you can optimize the order in which you connect your accessories to your PC. Gamers can plug keyboards and mice into ports with the lowest latency, while creators can plug into high-powered and speedy ports to take advantage of faster transfer speeds for larger files, and everyday users can make smarter choices about where to charge their phones or connect external devices. Presenting Technology Chatter with Benjamin Rockwell and Mark Brownstein.
Mark Brownstein joins me now. And Mark, I understand you've got a new set of earbuds from the company Shox.
Yeah, I sure do. Now, these are different from the ones that hang around the head, and those work great too. But the open dots one are my current choice. And let me tell you a story.
Okay.
I had to go somewhere, and in California and a lot of other states, the law says you cannot have two earbuds, one in each ear.
Yeah.
And if you do, you can get pulled over and all that stuff. I didn't want to take the chance, although a lot of people are passing me at 80 on surface streets. Mm-hmm. And I figure that if police were active, they'd go after these guys, yeah. not look to see what I've got in my ear, and certainly not look to see if both ears are covered.
Right.
But again, I didn't want to take a chance. So the Open Dots came up, and I figured I would use those. These are pretty much unobtrusive. Mm-hmm. One side fits behind the ear, the other goes sort of into the ear, but they're open. You really can hear what's going on outside when you're okay. wearing these things.
All right.
So I wore these when I went to a meeting and on the way back. And of course, nobody cared. When GPS announcements came up, the phone rang. I was able to talk on the phone. And this thing, these Open Dots are great for phone calls. As long as you're in a room that's not real loud.
Okay.
The mics will pick up all that noise. I walked into a grocery store. You can hear all the kids screaming. You could hear the carts banging. No way possible to use these for a phone call in a place like that.
Okay.
But if you're in an office or at home, they're ideal. I've used them for phone calls, and nobody has ever said they couldn't hear me clearly.
Okay.
And I could hear the other people clearly. I haven't found that in many earbuds. I do have the ViAIM, which I talked about a few weeks ago. Yeah. They do a great job at phone calls too, and they also do noise cancellation. But
with this being shocks, these are bone conduction, right?
Yes. Yes.
Okay. All right.
There's a battery behind it. It clips on the ear. You don't feel it. Sometimes I've had to touch my ear to make sure I've got this on my head. Mm-hmm. So they do the bone conduction, and they do good phone calls. And I'm really pleased with them. I have others that were more money and more capable and all that stuff. But for these, for what they do, they're great. And one other thing these will do that others do not mm-hmm. is that they can tell whether it's on a left ear or a right ear. So if you've got stereo going, yes. you can tell.
And it will, okay. I like
get
that.
Get separation. Oh, yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I like them. I'm using them right now. I've got a lot of other earbuds and ear headphones things. But I like these. These work okay. And the sound isn't bad. I'm not looking for hi-fi. I'm not looking for great fidelity.
Sure.
But they work.
Sure. All right, so what is the price point on those?
$200.
Okay.
Unless you can get them on sale. They have them on Amazon. Sure. You can go to Shops and buy them.
Sure. All right, I understand you also, you had a set of pans that you've also been reviewing.
Yeah. I sure do. They're Anolon, they're N2, which is nitrogen fortified or something, pans. They're cast steel.
Okay.
And a lot of people don't like cast steel. These things actually have more iron in them. I'm sorry, less iron in them than cast iron. They're not as fragile as cast iron. They're not as heavy. Mm-hmm. Okay. And if you wanted to give them to your grandkids, they'll last a long, long time.
Okay.
These need seasoning. They're supposed to be smooth and slick when you get them out of the box. They need a little seasoning. And seasoning doesn't mean salt and pepper. It means you got to rub some Crisco or some oil or something into them, heat them up. But the more you do this, the more nonstick they become.
Okay.
And I've got a wok, which I haven't quite used yet, but I've got a nice 10-inch fry pan that does a really good job. In this case, if you want to fry something, you don't have to use a lot of shortening or oil or grease or whatever you'd use. Motor oil didn't work at all when it's rated. Butter seems to work fine. A little bit of vegetable oil works fine.
Yeah.
And after a few uses, you don't really need much at all.
Yeah.
The stuff doesn't stick.
You know, I don't use, now if we turn into a cooking show, I don't use grapeseed oil for cooking. My wife is really against the idea of having seed oils around. But I will use grape seed oil for seasoning my, so I use cast iron pans. And I use that because the smoke point is just so high. It is very interesting how we are all of a sudden progressing into a new direction with cookware, and we're moving away from Teflon.
Oh yeah, we are. I have a set of porcelain skillets and stuff like that, and I'm concerned about scratching them or heat shocking them so that the porcelain cracks or breaks off. I still use a porcelain pan, but I am afraid of it. This cast iron, cast steel is impervious to metal implements. Unless you cut on it, you're fine.
Very cool. As for now, that's Mark Brownstein. My name is Benjamin Rock.
Thank you, Benjamin, and thank you, Mark. Public service announcements of computer club meetings in the New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut tri-state region. Log on to the club website for more information on remote meeting ID. The Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey meets Friday, January the 2nd, 2026. Meeting time is 8 p.m. Online virtual meeting via Jitsi. Website is acgnj.org. Tech Ed Connect meets Tuesday, January the 6th, 2026. Meeting time is 7 p.m. It's a hybrid meeting. They will meet at the Scarsdale Public Library, located at 54 Olmsted Road in Scarsdale, New York, and online virtual meeting via Zoom, and their website is techedconnect.org. The New York Amateur Computer Club will have a meeting Thursday, January the 8th, 2026. Meeting time is 7 p.m., and I'll give a presentation on my overview of AI, its short-term impact, and the long-term timeline. It's an online virtual meeting via Zoom, and the website is nyacc.org. The Brookdale Computer Users Group will meet Thursday, January the 8th, 2026. Meeting time is 6:45 p.m., online virtual meeting via Zoom. Website is bcug.com. Long Island Macintosh Users Group meets Friday, January the 9th, 2026. Meeting time is 7 p.m. Online virtual meeting via Zoom. Website is limac.org. The Kings Bite Computer Club meets Tuesday, January the 13th, 2026. Meeting time is 5:30 p.m. And they meet at the Brooklyn Heights Public Library in the Cranberry Meeting Room, located at 286 Cadman Plaza West in Brooklyn, New York. Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 5 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.live, streaming on the Internet. Podcasts of the Personal Computer Show programs are available on prn.live and podbeam.com. I welcome you, the listeners, to provide feedback as to what you want to hear, as well as if you have any questions for us. Address your comments and questions to hank@pcradioshow.org. In the meantime, stay in touch and remember to do regular backups. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Michael Horowitz, Benjamin Rockwell, Mark Brownstein, and Marty Winston, we thank you for listening. Stay safe and healthy until we meet again, same time, same station next week. Merry Christmas and happy holidays.